is tonight is the last of the second week of the Omer. And last year, we were zoche to work out together some of the spiritual forces that operate in these weeks. And we tried to work through the seven levels that a person is supposed to work on in these 7 weeks. And in each of the weeks, how one is supposed to work on each of the seven is broken into seven, and each seventh you work on one piece of the whole, which means 49 steps, right, in seven groups, working on the whole of human personality. Tonight is the night that is the completion, that's the seventh night of the second week. The whole idea of the second week, we're not going to go over last year's work again. But we'll try and take it further. We'll try and speak about some things we began then and try and look at them in more depth. But the whole idea of the second of seven is always self-control. When you look at a seven-stage process, the first is always the first of seven is always a giving that has no control. And that's called chesed. That means a giving so intense that nothing's held back at all. If it's done correctly, you shouldn't even feel pleasure, because it has to be so intense that you get nothing at all, because otherwise not giving. That's the first of the elements in character development. And it's almost impossible, if not impossible, to do correctly, because our problem is usually that the more we're able to give, the better we feel about it. If you can do something that's really a sacrifice, then you really feel good, which means that the vested interest involved in giving is even greater when you do it better. So the closer you get to real giving, the deeper becomes your vested interest, and not only do you feel good about it, which means you get something out of giving, but pride creeps in as well. So you really damage yourself through giving. So self-control of giving, how to give correctly in such a way that you retain nothing for yourself, is almost impossible, and that's the first stage in self-development. We discussed that in detail over the last few months. The second stage is self-control. The message is how to give with modification. That means how to express personality or any aspect of a relationship in such a way that there's control. One of the most deep and intense aspects of control is how not to speak. Now, you'll see that from the beginning, it's impossible to speak about this subject, because there are mystical commentaries that say the following thing. Let's just try and state the problem before we try and work it out. What we're going to try now and do is focus on why it's impossible to understand this subject through speaking. The only way one can ever understand the subject is through not saying it. But we are so confused today, we're at such a low level of spirituality, that if we sit here, if you sit there not saying anything, and I stand here not saying it, and neither of us will definitely understand anything, nothing. So we have to try and convey what we've been taught by our teachers through words. But the problem is that if words are inadequate anywhere, this is especially where they're inadequate. And I'll try and express that to you in a chazal. The chazal says the following thing. Now, we have to appeal again to remind ourselves that what we've worked on over the month is how not to hear the words literally, but how to translate them through that faculty of abstraction, which translates concepts into something that you can grasp without words. Yes? Again, not to understand the words physically. You do have to understand them literally. They are 100% literal, but certainly not physical. That means, as they always put it, the words don't mean at all what they say, and they mean exactly what they say. So a person has to, if you're going to hear the words as words, the whole subject doesn't begin. Again, the exercise is to hear the words, but immediately abstract them into a place that's beyond words. We'll try and work this out in more detail. So you have to switch on an intuitive faculty. The Chazal says the following thing, that when a child is at a stage before he can speak, when a child is being formed, when the child is inside his mother, it says that he has a special spiritual gift. It says in the Midrash that the child has a light that's lit above his head. Ne'er dolu kol roisho. He has a candle, a flame, that's lit above his head. But seifem is seifa oilam at seifa. He sees from one end of the world to the other. He sees from one end of the world to the other. That means the whole of spiritual wisdom is open to him. He understands the whole Torah, and specifically his chalik in Torah. That means a child is given the gift at that stage of seeing everything, knowing and understanding everything, especially where he fits into reality. An angel, it says, whatever that means, force called a malach, that experiences this phase with him and teaches the child all of this mystical spiritual wisdom. That's everything that there is to know about love. As he's being born, it says, Soisroi al piv, he hits him on the mouth. This mystical being hits the child on the mouth and immediately forgets everything. As he's born, he forgets everything that he learned. Now, there's a lot of explanation required about this whole thing in general. The first question that needs explanation is, what's the point of teaching a child something if you're then going to make him forget it? Why is an angel designated to teach a child everything, and then the same force that teaches him causes him to forget everything that he taught him? But that's a strange way of going about things. But the idea behind it is this, and we've discussed this in another context also. It's like this, that when a child's born, he doesn't really forget everything that he's been taught. Really what happens is, all that wisdom is driven into a level where he doesn't have immediate access to it. The wisdom is driven into a level so deep that it's there, but you can't draw on it when you want to. In other words, it's very necessary. It shapes everything that the person is going to be. But it's at a level that you can't draw on when you want. It means this, that every person is born, when he reaches consciousness, before age 13 or 12, it's one kind of consciousness, and when a child grows beyond that and beyond 20, it's another kind of consciousness. But a person grows into consciousness with the experience, not of learning something new, but of rediscovering something old. If you have any sensitivity, you'll realize that when you have an experience, you can test it out on yourself. If you have an accurate view of your own emotions, you'll know that when you hear something that's meaningful, or when you experience or hear something that's true, your response is not that you are learning something new. Your response is that you recognize something that you knew already. There's no way I can prove it to you, but anybody who's sensitive to his own experience will definitely know that that's the way it is. The feeling is a feeling of coming home. When you are told something that's true, it reverberates, it resonates with some aspect of the personality, and that's how you know it's true. If you ever ask yourself a simple exercise, how, when you hear something that's true, that you know it's true, how do you know that something that you know is true is true? How do you know that it's true? Are you with me? It's amazing. Again, when you hear something that's true, you know it's true. How do you know that? So there's two possibilities. If you have a very, very fragmented, superficial view of reality, you'll say because you trust the person who tells you, or because you can apply some technical external test. But that's not the answer. The answer is, you know it's true because you have a yardstick inside, you have a measuring tool, you have a sense of truth inside, and this thing measures up to that thing inside, and so you recognize it as being true. But the essential aspect is that you recognize. You don't learn, you recognize. And when you generate something that's true in the world, you simply bring out something that was there before. You know, even the very, very distant English understanding of this, in English the word education, the Latin root of education means to lead out. It doesn't mean to put in. But it's even as distant as the English language still has this understanding from the Hebrew and mystical source, that when you want to develop a human being, you don't fill him with information, you try and draw out his raw potential, you try and draw out that which is within. Again, this has many, many applications for those people who learn Torah. It's fascinating to know that this is the idea and the explanation behind how one can have what's called a chiddush. When a person learns Torah, one of the most exciting levels of learning is to be mechadash a chiddush. That means you come up with something that's original. You're learning a piece of Gemara or some piece of agadic material, something mystical, and you suddenly produce something original that wasn't said before. And great Gedolei Torah produce and write many times volumes of work that's their own Torah that they generated. But the obvious question is, how can you generate Torah? Torah is the definition of reality. That's what Hashem, God, puts into the world. It's the plan on which he builds the world, and it's what he expresses in the world. What a chutzpah to wake up and say, you created a piece of Torah. That's a tremendous chutzpah. Means to come up with something that you think is worthwhile, and you write a book, and other people go so far as to learn what you said and actually assimilate it as Torah. Somebody in the last generation writes a book of Torah, of the way things seem to him. He generates ideas of his own, and the next generation studies that as Torah. But that's a tremendous chutzpah. How can a human being come up with ideas obvious that you're not putting together something external? Since the truth is within, all you do when you make a chiddush is that you bring out something and polish it up and shine it. You allow the light to shine on it, but you didn't put together something that wasn't there before. Which really means that spiritual development is not the way the Balei Musa say. They say it's like dipping a bucket into a very deep well. You're bringing up water that was there all the time. Only it was too deep to get to and you couldn't see it before, but it was there all the time. So when you learn Torah, you're really not trying to take in information. You're trying to bring out information, but it's all there. So the exercise of life is to experience the world where you don't have ready access to that depth, and then the challenge is to dip the bucket in to bring out the depth that's there already and become, to make the superficial level so easily in contact with the deeper level that what speaks all the time is the deeper level and there's no conflict between the two. That's why this force, this mystical force, causes the child to forget what he learned before. But let's look a step deeper. It says clearly in Chazal that it's the same angel, it's the same force that teaches the child the knowledge that makes him forget it. That's a very important thing to note. It doesn't say that there's one agency that teaches the child the wisdom, and then when he's ready to be born, another agent comes along and makes him forget. It doesn't say that. And as you know, every detail in the Chazal is critically important. If they chose to express it that way, if the Kabbalistic depth was expressed that way, then it means that every single detail is critically important. So it means that the same force that teaches the child, the same essence, whatever that thing is, that puts in the spiritual wisdom, that is the force that makes you forget, that makes you unable to be in contact with it. And what is that force? This is what the Mefarshim say, that force is speech. The power of communication, it's the force of speech that speaks to the child. It's the element that teaches the child everything that he knows. When he gets given the gift of speech, he can no longer have access to it. When a child is born into the world where speech is possible, why does it say it hits him on the mouth? Why does it say the angel hits him on the mouth? That's not how you make somebody forget. When you want to make somebody forget, you punch him in the brain. That's how you make somebody forget something. It should say that the angel reaches into his mind or does, but it doesn't say that. It says, Seisroy al-pif, he smacks him on the mouth. What does a blow on the mouth have to do with forgetting spiritual wisdom? But the idea is this. The smack on the mouth, the blow on the mouth is the gift of speech. To prove that is a long story, but I'll just mention one clue for those who haven't. If you have studied these things to some extent, you'll understand from this more than we have time for this evening, and that is that it says that Ein lecha kol esev ba'olam, there's not a single blade of grass in the world, she'ein lo malach berakia, that doesn't have an angel in the spiritual world, she'makeh oisei, that hits it, ba'omer lo gedal, and says grow. Again, there's not a blade of grass in the world that doesn't have an angel, a spiritual core, not a spiritual essence at its core, that hits it and says to it, grow. That means anything that happens in the world happens because there's a transcendent force, what the Ramchal calls a koyach nivdal, a transcendent force that makes that thing take the next step in its development. But it doesn't say that the angel says grow, it says the angel hits it and says grow. There's a blow that is always, yes, when a malach wants to give a gift to something in the physical world, the way he brings him to the next stage is through a blow. He has to hit him. That we have to understand exactly what that is, if not tonight's subject, perhaps some other time. But there is an idea that it comes through a blow. And once he gives him that smack, that blow, then he can say to him, grow, and then the blade of grass can grow, move to the next stage. When the angel wants to give the child the gift that he'll need to use in the world, that he smacks him on the mouth. It's the blow in that place which opens the faculty of speech. And as soon as you're able to speak, you cannot anymore be connected with the spiritual wisdom. It's only if you can be silent. It's only a person that can go back to the stage where he knows what not to say, where you know how not to let out the power that's hidden inside, that power could start to throb. As soon as the gate is opened and it can leak out, it disappears. It does leak out. If a person enters a relationship in such a way that his habit is to tell the other person everything that's on his mind, so then he'll have nothing on his mind. Because once you let it out, once you share everything, once you live in such a way that everything that's meaningful to you, you express, then what you've done is that everything that's meaningful has been expressed. And if you put your essence of experience into words, then they are in the words. And once the words have been said, they're not with you. And you could never go beyond the level that your words could generate. You never have a pool deeper than that. Let's try and understand this idea more deeply. Since we're supposed to speak about on Monday nights and more mystical levels, let's not make the mistake of forgetting the practical side. Let's at least not be guilty of not mentioning the practical aspect, in case people think that it's all a mystical story. The place where this begins is in practical halacha. The person has to guard his speech in a practical way before we get to this mystical understanding. Mr. Shem will try and get to the deeper levels, but let's first understand that there's a practical level that has to be done before we can get to the deeper levels. A person who is aware of the spiritual depth of what control means, right, and works on that all the time, is not going to generate anything at all in his life if he's speaking Lashon Hara. If you're saying things you're not allowed to say, if you're using the tool of speech and you're perverting it by saying things you're not allowed to say, then the rest of tonight's subject's irrelevant. Not only irrelevant, but it says that the angels laugh at such a person. In the spiritual world, they mock, they laugh at a person who tries to work on spiritual levels while he's perverting the kli, while he's taking the vehicle and perverting it. But he's trying to get somewhere with that vehicle, that's a terrible, terrible joke. So the first thing always, as we've always tried to say, person has to keep the laws. Once you build the structure and you keep the laws, then you could try and understand the more refined spiritual levels and work on those. But the first thing. And therefore, if a person wants to get to this level, before you can travel inward to understand the greater depth, first of all, a person has to perfect the trick of using speech perfectly in the world in a mundane way. I'll give you a simple proof of this. A simple, obvious proof which you should be able to think of for yourself. And that is that the most perfect application, right, one of the most deep, the deepest uses of speech in the world is tefillah, davening, prayer. When you pray, you are mouthing words, and it's an exercise that's the ultimate transcendence. The person wants to rise to the level called Ratzon, what we discussed before, what's called the Makor, the height of a human, the place where your tefillin are. If you want to rise to that level and verge, interface with transcendence, so you do it through davening. Right? It's the exercise of the Shemona Esrei. As we explained the other day, it's that davening, that Amida, that level, which is the fourth of four worlds. We haven't got time for all, can't go into all the details, but again, when you daven in the morning, you go through four stages. The fourth stage is called Shemona Esrei, that's Amida. That's a completely transcendent level, which is why you don't move at all. The halacha is that if there's a snake coiled around your ankle, you don't respond, you don't move. There's such a transcendent level, not connected to the physical. And that's done through only one organ in the body that moves, and that's speech. Only the mouth operates. Which means that the most sublime use of speech, and one of the most is to get to that level of transcendence. So why is it that when you finish the Shemona Esrei, I mean, from what we've said already this evening, it should be obvious now, our question should not even need to be asked, why is it that when you finish Shemona Esrei, and you get to that incredible stage where you say your own name, as we discussed before on a Monday night, when you end of Shemona Esrei, you say Yehiyu L'Ratzon, for the second time, just before you say Yehiyu L'Ratzon, you say your name. You should say the verse in the Torah, you should say the verse, there's a verse in Tanakh, that corresponds to your name. Every Jewish name starts and ends with a certain letter. There's a verse that begins with that letter and ends with the letter that your name ends with. And you should say that pasuk, because it's introducing yourself to this whole thing. You start off with Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzhak, Elokei Yaakov. You start off calling on the creator of the world in the name of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. That's the heaviest name dropping possible. That you want to get listened to. So you use the schus of those incredibly great names. You mention their names to open the doors. That's what name dropping really is. But when you get to the end, you want to be included yourself. You want to get yourself in on the coattails of those great names. So when you tail off at the end of Shemona, just before you sign out, you say your name, that you shouldn't miss the boat. After you say your name, and you say your own personal tefillah, once you've said your name, you've already changed into the singular, right? The first person singular. The whole Shemona Esrei is plural. After Yehiyu L'Ratzon in the first time, it's all singular. Look carefully at the end of Shemona Esrei, you'll see it all changes into the singular. At that moment, when you start talking about yourself, and you're about to build up to introduce yourself, right, and make yourself part of this whole scene, there's five or six lines over there which are unintelligible. You've just davened Shmoneh Esrei. You've asked for 19 brokers. You've asked for everything that the world needs for the messianic revelation. You've transcended all the world. And then you add in the tefillah Elokai and the tefillah Sheni Merah. Guard my lips from evil and my tongue from this and that. And it's a whole tefillah about looking after what I say. What's that doing there? There are lots of personal things you could ask. Why is it? But it should be obvious from what we said. The reason is obvious. The reason is this. You daven to the Kodesh Baruch Hu. You use speech. You use speech. Use that tool that he gave you to try and reach transcendence. You try and bring down power. You try and bring down Shefa. You want the world to run. So you've reached up into those levels. But if you kind of, you're the kind of individual who perverts the tool of speech, right? If just before you daven that Shmoneh Esrei, you said a snide remark about somebody to somebody else, you perverted that tool. They're not going to listen to what you're saying. You can't take the tool. Yes? You can't take the very... It's bad enough to be unfaithful. But to be unfaithful with the same things that you use to express love for one person, use those things to be unfaithful to that woman. There's no way to hurt her more than that. The man would be unfaithful to a woman, chas v'shalom. So that's a terrible thing to do. But if you'd be unfaithful to her using the things that he used to express his love for her, well, what could be worse than that? How would she feel? How would a woman feel if a man were unfaithful and she sees he's with another woman? But how would she feel if she sees that he takes the other woman to the same places that he took her, and he does the same things and he says the very same words, the same things that he generated in love that they shared, he now uses the same tool for somebody else? That's a terrible pain. So in the spiritual world, if a person wants to use speech, wants to use that tool to reach transcendence, and that's the tool that he perverts, they're not only not going to listen to him, it says they laugh. In the spiritual world, they laugh. Namlai says that the Malachim stand, they laugh at you. That's not pleasant. There are bad consequences. So the idea is this. Once you finish your tefillah, and you start with those great names, and you bring it down, you're about to introduce your name, you better stop there. Because if you're the kind of person who usually uses speech to generate evil and negativity in the world, and now you're going to bring it down to you, but that's the worst kind of joke there could be in the spiritual world. It's a very serious thing. It's not funny at all. And therefore, before you say your name, you make a special request. You put in a special tefillah, special private singular tefillah, that the tool that you've used to express these elevated things, you should be able to maintain it and keep it pure. That's one application. When Chazal say, Chaim v'mavis b'yad ha'lashon, that life and death is in the power of the tongue, that's not some kind of exaggeration. It's not just poetic speech. It means of all the parts of the body that can be used for life, and the parts of the body that can be used for death, there's nothing more powerful than the tongue. That means speech is the core of life and death. And that's why the sin, the transgression, the spiritual damage that's done by speaking badly is worse, perhaps, in many ways worse than any other avera. And a person speaks Lashon Hara, you simply say a small comment that's negative about somebody to somebody else. In Halacha, it says it killed three people. It is Chazal not given to exaggeration. Now, if you know something about somebody that's not complimentary, but it's 100% true, and you repeat it to somebody else, it says clearly that it kills three people. It kills the person you spoke about, because it ruins his personality, yeah? Exposes him to the world for that thing which is true. It kills you, because you're a Baal Lashon Hara, which the Rambam says is one of the categories that a person cannot do tshuva for. If a person's a Baal Lashon Hara, he has no share in the world to come and cannot correct that. It can't do tshuva for it. You can do tshuva for it, but it's one of the 13 things that's so exceedingly difficult that the Rambam puts it in that category. And you kill the third person, the person who hurt. The person you speak to, right, who hears this negative thing about a third party, even though it's 100% true, in Halacha it says that's death. That's spiritual death. That's done through speaking. So a person wants to get to these refined levels of what it means, silence and speech and self-control and choosing the right words and so forth. First of all, the person has to make a conscious effort to guard speech. How do great people do that? I had a Rebbe who used to quite often, a Sfardi Rebbe, he used to quite often go on a Tainus Diburim. A Tainus Diburim means that you fast from speech. You fast just like you want to break the taiva for what goes into your mouth. You should try and break the taiva for what comes out of your mouth. So I used to spend the day in the Beis Medrash every night and he wouldn't speak. So if you went up to him and you asked him, he was trying to train himself in self-control in that area. So if you went up and asked him a question, he said, scarf wrapped around his neck, you know, like it was very painful, isn't it? Wouldn't talk to you. And he could do that for days. To train himself. Rav Miller says that when he was taken to see Rav Dessler for the first time as a little boy, Rav Mordechai Miller, author of Shabbat Shirim. When he was taken to see the great Rav Dessler for the first time, his father took him to ask Rav Dessler if he would teach him, the great giant of the last generation, Rav Dessler. So he says that they came in, they sat down at the table. Imagine this young boy's emotion. He was a young boy who was taken to see one of the greatest people alive. He sat down at the table, shaking with trepidation and with the emotion of being in the presence of this great man. And when his father asked Rav Dessler a question, simple question, very simple, basic, or nothing mystical about it, simple, straightforward question of the God. So Rav Dessler put his head in his hands and he thought and thought and thought and thought, and after many, many minutes of silence, he answered. Then his father asked him another question, very, very straightforward, simple question about the child. And he thought and thought and thought. After many minutes of silence, he goes, and the answer wasn't anything staggering. The answer was a simple answer, simple. You know, you have to understand, as his father would have said to Rav Dessler, I imagine the conversation went something like this. Is it possible, you know, when could my boy start learning with you? He said, and he said, thought. After 5 minutes, he said, tomorrow. And then he said, that's how the conversation went. And then he said, are you sure that would be okay? So Rav Dessler thought. Afterwards, Rav Miller said that when he was older, he understood that it was one of the phases in Rav Dessler's life that he was going through working shlita on dibur. He was going through self-control training in controlling the power of speech. And he wanted to make sure that the sentence that he would say would be ultimately controlled. There wouldn't be a single word that wasn't necessary. There wouldn't be a single connotation or overtone that was not desired. And he was training himself in that way. Let's look at one slightly more mystical level. And that's as follows. The power of speech is so intense in the world that it generates reality. We've discussed this from other points of view before, we're not going to go into it again, but let's just pick out one aspect. We know that the world was created through speech. Yeah? A davar in the world, like we've said many times, an object, the Hebrew word for an object is also the Hebrew word for a word. That means every object in the world, every entity in the world, is really a word of Hashem. That means the power of creation is the power of speech. That's how powerful it is. When Hashem wants to create something in the world, he doesn't snap his fingers, he doesn't get some angel to do it. It says he says it. Huh? When Hashem says the word, the thing exists. So speech is that which actually creates. That power is so intense that a person who uses it correctly can create reality. A person who uses speech correctly can change the world upside down. How far does that go? There's a statement that says like this. Tzadik goyzer v'kodesh baruch hu mekayem. When a tzaddik says something, Hashem obeys him. When a tzaddik says something, when a righteous individual says something in the world, Hashem changes the whole universe to activate the words that were said by a tzaddik. And it's so intense that even if it's something that he made contingent on a t'nai, on a condition, and the condition is not fulfilled, the thing still happens in some way. That means if a tzaddik lets a word out of his mouth, it is so powerful that it must come to pass in the world. That's what it says. You'll notice fascinating things. Sometimes when you're going through the Gemara, sometimes you'll see in the Gemara a very strange thing. You'll see there's a conversation in the Gemara that's taking place in the second person. You this and you this and you this and you this. And suddenly it changes to the third person, he. But the idea is this. Two people sitting learning Gemara, you're quoting words. You don't mean you. You mean the you in the Gemara. You're reading a piece of text and you're quoting a conversation, but you're saying it to your chavrusa. So there's a slight hint that it could be understood as being you. And if it's something negative, you have been guilty of saying something, huh? Let's say you say something chas v'shalom to do with the opposite of life, or some spiritual curse or something negative. Even though you don't mean you, you're simply reading words. But you faced a human being and you said that, the Gemara changes it to he. This is so sensitive to it. The problem is that we've reached such a level of desperation. We're at such a low level now. There's so much noise in the world that speech is completely meaningless now. Today, you don't have to have any fear that if you say something, it will happen. Today, alavai, if you say something, somebody should understand a fraction of what you said. Never mind that world should be overturned. Today, it's been so sullied and so perverted that speech today is such a noise that nobody hears. Nobody pays any attention, doesn't do anything in the world anymore. And nobody even means what they say, and nobody hears, and nobody understands the terrible, terrible state that most powerful and holy of forces has come to in the world. So today we're way below all this. But that's what the power of speech is supposed to be. And that's why control in this area has such importance. Now let's try and look at it from a deeper perspective. Okay, now we need the quality of abstraction. We're now going to begin, Mit Hashem, to try and look at the subject from the level where you can't use any words, okay, what we started off trying to talk about. So now let's try our best. We're trying to use very, very inadequate tools, okay? We're trying to use tools that are the tools of forgetting the wisdom. When the child is able to start speaking, that's what makes him forget the wisdom. We are now going to try and do the almost futile exercise of get to the hidden wisdom using the tool that makes you forget that wisdom. Let's understand how difficult it is. Which means that if any of us understand anything, then for sure you didn't understand. Right? If you think you understood, then for sure you got it wrong. That's what my Rebbe said. So all we can do is say the words and hope that something will get through into that, through that filter. There's a faculty in the mind that begins where words end. In some of the Mephoshim, it's called Seichel Ha'iyuni. Iyun. Iyun means a faculty of depth that's so deep that it's like a spring. You know, the word Iyun in Hebrew, that's the best way to get to it, is to understand what that word means. Iyun is from the root Ayin, which means the eye, or Ma'ayan, which means a spring, a hidden spring. What's in common between all those three things, Iyun, Ayin, and Ma'ayan, is that they all describe a process of something coming from the hidden dimension into the revealed dimension. And Ma'ayan, a spring, is a place where the hidden water comes to the surface. And Ma'ayan is the place where a river begins. It's where the water that's underground that you can't see comes to the surface. It brings it out. The Ayin is a tool, an organ, that brings in something. Yeah, you see something. Something that you didn't see before, that was hidden, you now perceive, right? You see it. It brings it into vision. That's the Ayin. Iyun, when you study Be'iyun, what people who study Gemara, when they study Be'iyun, when you learn Torah, what's called Be'iyun, which means in depth, people always understand that wrongly. People think that studying Be'iyun means you look at it intensely, because the root Ayin, but it's quite the contrary. Really, when you study Be'iyun, you close your eyes. When you really want to study something Be'iyun, really Be'iyun, so you close your eyes. The concept is that Iyun means looking so deeply into the Gemara that you bring out that which was hidden before. You make a Ma'ayan out of Torah. You look into Torah so deeply that it becomes a well or a spring where the wisdom is hidden, but by piercing through the outer layer, you bring out the hidden depth. That's why it's called Iyun, not because you look at it, on the contrary, because you look with a deeper eye. That's why it's called Iyun. Seichela Iyuni means that it's a level of intellect above, it's a level of intellect that's hidden. It's a level of spiritual depth that's hidden. That you cannot get to it with external tools. You can't see it, and you can't get to it, and you can't express it with external tools like words. But that's where you live. That's where you really live. If you don't have a store of depth beyond what you can express, then you're not alive. Then you're like a vehicle of communication that the media use, that spews out words without anything deeper than the words. If you listen to one of these, any method of communication that the media use, you're looking at a tool, a machine, that spews out words, but doesn't have any understanding deeper than, it has the words, but nothing deeper than the words. So if you generate that same level as a human being, everything you're conscious of you're able to say, so you're no better than that instrument. The whole point of being human is that for everything you say, there's a world that's so much deeper that can't possibly be said. That's what makes you human. It's the hidden level. It's the hidden world. Let's try and explore this. We're not going to be able to say it, as I've said before. But what we can do is look at some applications and correlations of this thing, and then maybe it will dawn in the inner world. Let's look at two very, very beautiful examples. We've mentioned them before in other contexts. Let's try and understand them here. It says that Moses couldn't speak properly. Moshe Rabbeinu, he couldn't speak properly. Kvad peh and kvad loshi. The organs of speech, they were imperfect. Couldn't speak. So the way that's been interpreted, and you'll understand after this discussion, I hope, what we've had up to now, you should understand why it's been done this way. That's always been taught in its most violently anti-Semitic misunderstanding. Anybody who understands, examine your own consciousness, you'll see you grew up with Bible stories of what Moses stuttered, couldn't speak. He stuttered, he had speech defect. You know, his father probably smacked him at a sensitive age of his development when he was 3, and it gave him psychological problems, and you know, he grew up with a stutter. That's the most anti-Torah, anti-Semitic perversion of spirituality that you could imagine. The Maral explains like this. You have to hear well. Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't speak, not because he had any defect. That was his perfection. He was holding at such a level of spiritual existence. He had such clarity in the spiritual world. He was holding at such a level of depth that everything that was in his consciousness was that which can't be said in words. So he couldn't speak. Not because he had anything wrong with him, but because he had so much right. He was holding in such perfection that if he would have been able to squeeze it and contract it and compress it into finite words, he would have killed it. Words are finite. Words are completely finite fragments. You can't put even a simple thing like a taste you can't express in words. Try and communicate with all the eloquence at your command to a friend of yours what something tastes like or feels like. You can't possibly, the only way you can ever communicate an experience like that is by appealing to him to experience something that he experiences. And then he can plug into his own experience, but he can't plug into yours. It's clear. The words are so low, they're so finite, they're so distant from the experience, that there's no way you can communicate anything meaningful with the words. Of course, it means, as an aside, a person has to understand right away that when two people talk to each other, when two people know each other very well, and two people have a deep relationship with each other, it's what they don't say that's meaningful. It's not what you say to each other. It's what you can't say to each other. You want to share something deep with a friend, and it's an agony, because one of the deepest human needs is that something specially meaningful or beautiful generates immediately a tremendous desire to be able to share it. In fact, many people are so sensitive to this that they can't enjoy anything unless they can give it over to somebody else. And in fact, even when they're enjoying something on their own, the whole enjoyment is a fantasy of how they could be sharing it with somebody. Examine it, you'll see, understand what I mean. So you never can tell the other person what you experience. You hope to find somebody so sensitive that when you try and explain to them what it is that you feel, they sense it enough to have felt it themselves. But they don't feel what you feel. But by understanding their own personal experience, they understand you. But if you really get to a level of communication, you don't have to say anything. I heard from my Rebbe that once, I hope I have the names correct, I've forgotten who the one person was. One was Rav Yitzchak Hutner, that's all. He was sitting in a sukkah one year. I may be wrong about who it was, but two of the Gedolim of that generation. He was there to see the following thing. He was sitting in his Rebbe's sukkah, and Rav Hutner was sitting in the sukkah. And on sukkahs came to pay him a visit one of the other Gedolei Ador. I don't want to say who because I might have the name wrong. Then he walked into the sukkah. There were a meeting of tremendous minds. Two of the greatest men alive in that generation. Huh? Tremendous spiritual power. He walked in and sat down and he said to him, "Good yomtov." And he said back to him, "Good yomtov." And they sat for half an hour without saying anything. And they said, "Good yomtov" to each other, and he walked out. That was it. And he said it was the most incredibly deep experience of communication that you could imagine. Did they really spoke to each other? What we do is, we fill half an hour with such intense nonsense that nothing was said at all. That's what we've done to it. The two men on that level could sit and not say anything and rarely speak. What we do when we speak, we don't say anything, and much worse than that. All you ever succeed in doing when you try to speak to somebody, you fool him about what it was you wanted to say. And usually you fool yourself too. That's what our speech is. Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't speak because his concepts were at such a level of infinity. He was at such a level of... Every concept was so enormous and interlocked with so much in the cosmic reality that it couldn't possibly be frozen into a word. So of course he couldn't say it in the world. But of course we've been perverted into seeing it the opposite, because our communication of Torah has been so perverted that we shrink it all to our size. So instead of understanding his depth and what his level was and what a greatness it was that he couldn't say anything in the world, we think he had a speech defect.
But it's a tremendous perversion of Torah. That's a perversion inside the perversion. The Maharal says that after Hashem gave Torah, Moses spoke normally. After Torah was given in the world, Moshe Rabbeinu spoke normally. Speech defect disappeared. Why? What does it mean for Torah to be given to the world? The giving of Torah means that which is infinite, what is Torah? Torah is an infinite thing. Right? It's an infinite reality. And it's frozen into some words. That's impossible. That's impossible. That's impossible to take something from Eon. It's impossible to take something from the spiritual world and put it in the physical world, but Hashem can do that. Just as it's impossible for a human soul to live inside a human body, that's impossible. That's called a pele. Pele means that which can never be done. Right? It's the opposite of Aleph, which is the silent letter which can never be said. That's what pele means. Those two things that can never be put together. But Hashem does that. He puts those two incredible opposites together. So he put Torah into the world. He took the infinite dimension, which is Torah, and he put it in words. So after that was done, Moses could speak. Once the capacity for holding the infinite inside the finite, amazing and impossible though it may be, once that was done in the world, so Moshe Rabbeinu could speak, he could do that too. Of course, because what he spoke was Torah. And it's only when you speak something like Torah that you could take something from the infinite and you could throw it in the finite. But that's because when you hear a word of Torah, it reverberates and resonates into so many worlds that there's no beginning of understanding where it's going. But that's what speech is for. Let's look at one other amazing example. Let's introduce it like this. We've spoken before that there's seven levels in the body and that there's three levels in the mind. The world is made of 10 levels. We've tried many times to go through this in Sfiras HaEmet last year again. We worked through it in detail. The seven levels that are manifest, and that's why we count 7 times 7, those are the levels we can work on. Those are the levels that are manifest and you can see and experience. The three that generate them, what's called Chochmah, Bina, and Das, or something that's beyond those, and Chochmah and Bina, whatever these levels are, these levels cannot be experienced directly in the world. But they are the root of everything that can be experienced. Again, as we said before, the crude example would be, you have to follow me well now, you have to hear well. The crude example would be, if you want to understand who somebody is, then what they are is what they are internally. It's what they are in their neshama. It's what they are as a human being, as a personality, not what their body is. Their body is dispensable. It can be changed, and it does change, and it will change. But what they are is the piece of infinity. And who you love and what you relate to is the person inside. It's not the tissue. Of course, again, this generation has devolved to such a superficial level that all they're concerned about is the meat. This generation has lowered itself to a level where all they're concerned about and all they sell and buy, right, is that part of you that does not look different from a gorilla. There's no question about that, and they've got a whole philosophy that explains that you aren't any different from a gorilla. So that's what the world's based on. But that's not what's real about being human. What's meaningful and what's real and what a marriage is, what a love is, what a friendship is, what a parent is relating to a child, it's the person inside, it's not the body. The body gets badly damaged, chasson, doesn't change anything. Right? But that person inside you never have access to. You never can experience the person. Never. You can't experience. You don't have a tool. You don't have an organ that can feel. Yes? His person is not expressed. And your person, you, it doesn't have an organ that can feel his person. So you never relate to another human being. The only way you ever relate to another human is your body relates to his body. That means you see what he does with his body and you understand through your filter of abstraction what he must be inside. If he causes you pain with his body, then you understand that the person, the essence, is cruel. If the person gives you a gift at great cost to himself, you understand that the person is generous or kind. But you never experience the person. You only experience a physical hand picking up a physical object and moving it in space. But because you have a natural ability to abstract, what we started with this evening, the whole message has to be abstracted into that place of reality. Because you have a natural ability to abstract into reality, so when you see a hand move, or a mouth move, or a person generate an expression on his face, you understand intuitively something about who he is. But it has to be understood very clearly. You only do it through the medium. When you look at the world, you're not seeing Hashem. But it's the only avenue of access you have to the reality of the world. If you switch in your capacity to abstract. If you don't, so then you're looking at something superficial and physical.
Now, those three levels, which you can never experience, can never see directly, you can only interpolate or explain or work out what they must have been through seeing what they do. Stay with me. If you lift that one step higher, stay with me carefully. Look at the body. You have seven levels in the body. Those you can see. You see what they do. If you want to move up into the head, into the mind, so you have three levels there that you can't see. The head can't see what I'm thinking. But by watching the body, you can see there it's what the body does, an expression of those hidden levels. Let's move up into the mind. Got seven levels in the mind also. Those seven levels in the mind are what you can experience within yourself. When you go up into your own being, you can work out and discern seven levels. Let's not go into why there's seven, but you can relate to yourself. Three levels above those. There are three levels above those that generate those seven that are hidden. But you can get in touch with what they are by being in touch with what you think. If you're in touch with the levels that you can be in touch with, sensitively so, then you can apply your power of abstraction one degree more sensitively, and you can have an understanding of that which you can never grasp in words. Again. The problem with us, the reason we don't do this exercise, is because we're so trained in superficiality that when we think, we go abstract. When we think, you know what our thinking is? It's embarrassing. Our thinking is a conversation. That's what our thinking is. It's words. How do you think to yourself? You say something, then you run around in your mind and you hear it, and then you think out of it. You run back and you say back again. That's what your thinking is. You have a conversation. Sometimes very embarrassing. You actually go through the... Sometimes you even get stuck on the words. That's what our thinking is. That's how puny and putrid our spiritual level is. That means even in our abstract dimension, which is supposed to be the place where you live beyond the finite level, even when we get up there, we're so constrained by physicality that we can't think unless we speak it out. We don't grasp anything in its essence. We only grasp the way the words say. So, if you ever caught yourself trying to understand something, you'll realize that the way you do, you try and explain it to yourself. So you try and sort of say it out to yourself. And sometimes if you really have trouble, you start speaking to yourself. But never understand anything that way. It's just like when the child is given the gift of speech, he has not access to the depth. As soon as you try to put it in words, you lose it. But a classic example of this, and we mentioned this example in other contexts before, a classical example is how when you try and do a thing through the explicit level, it eludes you. But when you fall asleep, for example, let's say you're working on a Gemara. So you spend 6 hours working on a mathematical problem or something, and you've got all the pieces together, and you work it all out, right? And it explains, you have the answer, and how they don't understand it. That means you can run through all the stages, and you can see this equals this, and you have a final conclusion at the end, and you can repeat it backwards and forwards and sideways, but you don't understand what it means. You ever had that experience? That means, you know, they've told it to you 400 times, so you can say it over, and you can write it out, you know, with your eyes closed. But what it actually means, they understand it, how they got that answer, you can't understand. Right? You go to sleep, you wake up the next morning, understand. What happened? All that happened was when you were sleeping, you switched off the external mind, that's all. That's what meditation is, by the way. Meditation. What the Easterns try and explain to you, or Jewish mystics, when they try and explain to you what meditation is, they tell you you have to switch off the mind. But they don't mean you have to switch off the mind. Meditation doesn't mean being a zombie. Meditation doesn't mean sitting there with the lights out, blank. That's rest. That might be relaxing. It's a good exercise. And so forth and so on. And it's healthy and all the rest of it, but it's not meditation. Meditation doesn't mean switching off the mind. Meditation means switching on the mind. It means switching off the superficial. It means switching off the words. When you stop arguing with yourself and trying to prove it in words and figures and pictures, not pictures, the words also, same thing, then the mind can start functioning, that you could understand something. But of course we get very nervous in that domain. As soon as we function like where there's none to hold on to, you can't put it in a picture or a word or a symbol, so then you feel you're sort of floating, you get a bit anxious about it, and you want to have it explained. What does explained means? Put into words. When do you lose it again? Okay. Therefore, the point of being human, the point of being spiritual, what a person wants to achieve, to really understand something, is by able to transcend to a point where there's such a unity that the thing is because it is. And not because it's explained this way or explained that way or because it's pictured this way or pictured that way, but because the thing is what it is. That's a faculty that you could... The test of that faculty is the fact that you can't explain it to anybody else. If you suddenly get it and you rush out with your friend to tell him, you're a fool. If you suddenly get it, you suddenly realize that you could never explain it to him. If you've got the right kind of friend, you don't have to explain it to him. If he understands that kind of thing already, that's the kind of friend you want. But if you have to, that's what we're looking for. That level has to be deepened and deepened and deepened. It has to go further and further and further. Let me give you an example that illustrates it very, very beautifully. This week in the Sedra, last week, 2 days ago, we read on Shabbos, Shmini, Basha Shmini. But in the Haftarah, there's the most amazing thing. In the Haftarah this week, there's the most amazing event that happened. Let me describe to you the event, and we'll try and understand it. It says the following thing. David HaMelech, King David, when he wanted to bring the Aron, right, the ark in which was the Sefer Torah, the broken pieces of the first Luchos, the Luchos HaBrit, the holy ark of the covenant, he wanted to bring it to Yerushalayim. So there's a whole series of events what happened over there. Tragedy happened on the way. Long story, one of the longest haftaras. A long series of events. But there's one outstanding and amazing example, and it's very, very amazing because it's an exchange between a man and a woman. You have to try and understand that as well. I don't know if we'll have time to bring that out as well, but try and hold that level at the same time, especially as we try to work out what is a man, what is a woman over the last few months also. As David HaMelech brought the Aron HaKodesh towards Yerushalayim, this is what happened. Every 6 steps that they walked, they stopped, they offered korbanos, there was tremendous rejoicing, it was a tremendously spiritual event. David HaMelech himself, as he walked with the Aron, it said he was dressed in a linen garment, and he was dancing in a way that was so intense, there's almost no way to describe it. It says he was mecharker b'chol oiz lifnei Hashem. He was, no words to describe, he was dancing in such a way, right? He was dancing in a tremendously expressive way, right? In the street, in joy, ecstasy. Looking from the window was Michal, his wife. Michal, the daughter of Saul, right? The late King Saul, his daughter was the wife of David HaMelech. So David was dancing in the street, and she was watching from the window. And the people were watching also. When King David got home, it says that he handed out things to the people, and he benched the people, and then he came home to be Mavarach his house, to bench his house. She came out to meet him, and she criticized him sharply. She said to him, "That's a fine day today, that the king of Israel has so revealed himself in the street. Right? In the eyes of his maidservants, you exposed yourself." That means you danced so immodestly. Right? It wasn't becoming. It wasn't fitting. You exposed yourself. That, you know, the way you would imagine the king dancing in the street. You know, you could see his ankles probably. He exposed himself. It wasn't fitting. It wasn't according to the dignity of the king. And she said to him, "You didn't behave the way a king should behave. You exposed yourself in the eyes of the common people." That's what she said to him. So David said to her like this. He said to her, "The people in whose eyes you say I exposed myself, I will expose myself even more in front of those people," right? "B'sham ikaveda, among those maidservants whom you say that I revealed more of myself than I should have," right? I was immodest. "I will reveal even more." And David says to her like this, "Unekaleisi oid mizois, I will be even lower." Kal means light. I will be even lighter, even less mechubit, even less with a darga of honor, right, of covet of the melech, I will reveal and lower myself even more. That means to dance in front of Hashem. The concept of malchus in mystical terms, the concept of the king is that he has nothing of his own. Not what it says in mystical terms, leis leimi degarmei klum. He has nothing of his own at all. That's what a king is in Jewish terms. The concept of malchus is that it has nothing of its own, it only receives the higher. That's what the king is. So I'll open myself even more than that, and I'll reveal even more. What happened? It says that because Michal said that to him, she never had a child from then until the day of her death. And there's a machlekes in Chazal. One opinion is she never had a child, or she may have had children before, but she never had. And another opinion is that she died in childbirth. That means Ad Yom Moisa means she never had a child until the day of her death. Until the day of her death, on that day she had a child, but she died to give birth to that child. Now let's think about this. What's going on? The king's dancing in the street the way he sees fit. He learned chat. That's how you have to dance. He learned that that's how you have to show the honor of Hashem by showing your own, yep, exposing your own, yourself. That's what you do. You don't keep your own honor when it's in front of Hashem's honor. It's honor, the honor of Hashem. That's how you dance. And she says to him, you did too much, you exposed too much. Yes, you were too low, you were too humble. You too. And David says, no, you're wrong. You're wrong, I wasn't too humble. I'm going to be even more humble than that. Right? I'm going to be even lower than that. And because of that, she deserved not to have a child until she died. She had to die in childbirth. That's a husband and wife having a discussion. That's a husband and wife. Rebbetzin says to Rosh Hashiva, you shouldn't take out the garbage. That's not fitting for you to take out the garbage. Get one of the Talmudians to take out the garbage. He says, no, I want to show that I'm humble. And because of that, she doesn't have a child. Like that. What's going on? And it chats like this. I heard this. It's very... I remember I heard this some years ago from my Rebbe. And he told the story once in the middle of a show. He stopped and he told us this. And he said that he heard this when he was 10 years old. And the fact that he could understand it when he was 10 years old, I don't understand. At least even that he remembered it. But he said when he was 10 years old, he was sitting with some Hasidim in Tel Aviv. And in those days, he used to go every Shabbos afternoon and sit with these old Hasidim. They were very simple people. They were tinsmiths. And they were simple people. But on Shabbos, he said, they looked like Malachi Asharis. They looked like angels. They glowed. On Shabbos, especially Shabbos Shiddur's time, as Shabbos, as the light dims, as the dusk approaches on Shabbos, it's a very high time. That's when all three elements of Shabbos form one. It's a very, very high time. And as the light faded, they would sit around the table at Shabbos Shiddur's and they would exchange vatlach. They would say a devout Torah. They would all say something. And it happened to be Parsha Shmini. And one of the Hasidim asked this question. He said, what was this exchange between David and Michal? What were they talking about? And explained it as follows. Understand something very deep. The argument was as follows. Michal was not concerned that she could see David's ankles. That didn't bother her. She wasn't concerned, yes, the fact that David HaMelech was dancing in the street in such a way that maybe you could see his feet or you could see his ankles or maybe perhaps on his knees, that's not what was bothering Michal. Tanakh doesn't talk about such things. When you're talking Torah, talking Tanakh, we're talking at a level that's much, much, much deeper than that. We're talking at a level that is so deep that there are no words. And therefore Tanakh uses words that there are, but it's trying to convey something that they can't be put in words. Except since there aren't words for those things, Tanakh can't tell you those things. So what it does is it puts it in words that you can understand, but you have to have the maturity to be able to see beyond the words into the hidden world to understand what it's telling you. Of course, when you're 6 years old, you read the words, and that's fine, it's also true. But when you mature beyond that and you open a level of abstraction, so you have to read Tanakh that way. And this is what the discussion was. When Michal looked out of the window, she saw David, dancing in such a way, not that you saw his ankles, you saw his neshama. You saw his soul. You may be sure that when David HaMelech danced, you didn't see a man jumping up and down in the street. His dance was so spiritual. Everything that he did, that he was, the Melech HaMashiach is going to come out of him. Everything that he did was pure transcendence. When David danced in the street, you could see his neshama. What is dance? We'll have to go into that some other time. But dance is to go into what art is and music and dance, but dance is a tremendous expression of pnimius. That's why Hasidus brought out dance. When Hasidim, one of the great elements of Hasidism, was tremendously expressive dance. And if you see it, if you know how to, if you see dance like that, if you compare that to the sordid level out of what the world does these days, it's not dancing at all. But when you go never to a wedding these days and you see bride and groom, they're getting married, the people get onto the floor and rub each other. That's what they do, not dancing. It has nothing to do with spirituality. That's a sordid expression. The music is sordid and the physical expression of that music is sordid. Nothing spiritual about that at all. And it's not bad enough, they do it with other people's wives also. They've got to do it with a bride also. At that moment of spirituality that a wedding's supposed to be, do you understand why we put a mechitza at a religious wedding? Not only that we don't watch women dance, we put a big divider down the hall and they dance in private. It's much too dangerous to watch women dance. It can't be trusted. A man watches a woman dance, a woman knows how to express her pnimius in dance. That's why we don't listen to a woman sing either, by the way. It's not because we're medieval, straight-laced. Not because of that. It's because when a woman sings, that she brings out her pnimius if she knows how to do it. And when a woman dances, she brings out her internality. And that's something you shouldn't look at. That's private. So we hide that. When David danced, you saw the deepest levels of his neshama. You saw who he was. And Michal said to him, that's not allowed. That's not allowed. Because in order to be able to be spiritual, You always have to have more than what you show. If what you speak in the world is what you have, you're empty. And if you look in the words over there, Naftari, you'll see it's beautiful. She said to him, Ke'echad harekim, like one of the empty fellows. She meant it literally. She didn't say to him, you dance like an empty lout. She meant literally empty. That means you danced yourself out. You danced so incredibly expressively, spiritually out there, that people could see your depth. They saw who you were. You left nothing behind. And that's not human. Right? If you can expand everything you are, so you're finite. The whole cutting thing human is that you go up into the infinite. That there's always more. No matter how much you grow, you go further. So if you could dance, or you could speak, or you could do anything with the body, to the point that somebody could see the level that it ends at, so that's where you end. You're finite. You're not connected. You're not hooked up anymore. You're dead. There always has to be a pool that's deeper than what you can express. So you died out there. You exposed yourself. We could see you. The simple maidservants could see everything that you are. And that's not allowed. That's not for a king. That's not for anybody. So David said to her, Nukalosi oid mizais. You've got me wrong. You think that's all there is? Think that's how far it goes? Doesn't go further than that? Nukalosi oid mizais. There's a lot more that wasn't shown. You misread me. You think what I expose is everything that I am was just the tip. What you saw out there in the street wasn't my neshama. It was a tiny chink of vision into what goes deeper beneath the surface. But what's beyond that? You think you saw the end of the depth? You didn't even see what begins beyond it. You so superficially misread me that you failed to see the reality. When the Kalesi owed me to this, there's plenty more. Right? What you saw was just the beginning. And for that she didn't have a child. Because if you want to bring out life into the world, you want to be a source of life in the world, you've got to be hooked up to the source of life. The woman wants to bring forth life in the world. So she's got to be hooked into the hidden dimension in such a way that she could bring forth life. And that's why she had a child when she died. When she gave her life for it, she could give forth life in the world. That's the change. All right, I think we'll leave it there for today.